All right, we're going to be moving into our Q&A session now. Just a note, we are going to be recording the Q&A, so if you have a question you want to ask, please wait for me to get to you with the microphone so you can ask it into the mic and we can record it. We have a question that's been submitted, so I'm going to leave it to Dr. Weeks to launch straight into that one.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm just going to move my rubbish out the way.
Okay, I should explain to start with, I have a hearing problem. And so, if I don't understand your question, if I ask that it be repeated, it has nothing to do with the problem of your question. It has to do with my hearing problem. Let's start with that. Okay, got a question. With the history of Islam, how do you see their influence in Australia coinciding the way society, government, is suppressing all things Christian? That's the first question. The second one, Australia was built on Christian values in schools, government, opening sessions in prayer, etc. Now even Christmas celebrations of Jesus' birth are threatened. What is your wisdom, please? Now, Lord willing, I am due in 2 days' time to give a talk on modern Islam. Now, I could regurgitate my talk on Islam here, but I won't inflict that on you. What I would say is, it is important that we realise that Islam is not monolithic. Islam is not a unified force. Just before the federal election, Jan and I were at a meeting which was concerned with the potential of a Labor government being elected. Who sponsored the meeting? Muslims. Why? Because Muslims are not stupid. The atheist, agnostic, anti-Christian direction of much of modern society is as much a threat to Islam as it is to Christians. There were teachers there from a Shiite school. I say Islam is not monolithic. There are Sunnis and there are Shiites. Never confuse them. There are teachers there from a Shiite school who totally agreed with us. There was a danger to them and to us from the anti-Christian direction. You may be aware that the electorates that voted against same-sex marriage tended to be electorates with a very high Muslim population. Islam is anti-Christian. Islam is threatened by secular society. That's the complex. I had the... Someone open that door, thanks. I had the privilege of living in the Middle East in an Islamic neighbourhood. It's a wonderful place to live. They're such nice people. I have had great relations with my Islamic students at the University of Sydney. I even ended up doing marriage counselling informally for a Muslim student who came to me for advice. don't think Islam is monolithic. There are militant elements in Islam that are very, very nasty and dangerous. There are all sorts of other currents in Islam, some of which we could agree with and cooperate with on the purely political level. Because anything that threatens Christian schools from a secular viewpoint will threaten Islamic schools. We should not think that there is some sort of conspiracy between the secularists and the Islamists. They will cooperate in certain things because they see the Christians as the enemy. There'll be certain things in which we will cooperate with the Muslims because the secularists are the enemy. It is a very complex situation, but let me retail something from my experience of living in a Muslim environment. We could walk down our alley and people who knew one word of English would say, "Welcome," and drag us in and feed us. If we did that to our Muslim migrants, we would have a very different situation. Now, I know there are problems because of their food laws, but you can ask, what can you eat? And I'll tell you. The average Muslim is not a threat. The average Muslim is an opportunity for evangelism. They respond very well to friendship. Our enemy is the secularists, not the Muslims. Now, I have to disagree with the premise of the next question. Australia was built on Christian values in schools, government, etc. I'm afraid I disagree. There was Christian influence, but I don't think it was dominant Christian influence. Give you a simple example. The first fleet with the convicts and the soldiers had an Anglican chaplain who was an evangelical. William Wilberforce was instrumental in getting him appointed. He was an evangelical. Governor Phillip said to him, "Stop preaching the gospel, because he's conducting services on the ship, preaching the gospel. Preach morality. We need morality to control these convicts." That was the official British government attitude to Australia. Morality is a good thing, and the only morality then they had was Christian morality. We need morality to control people. Not saying there weren't Christians. Obviously, the chaplain was a Christian. And many of the people who came were Christians. But the dominant approach of the British government was, we don't want Christianity, we want morality. Now, why didn't the English upper classes want Christianity? Because they were rotten themselves. They didn't want their sin exposed. Give you another example. The official British policy in India was, don't preach the gospel. It might disturb the natives, and we want to keep them under control. That was official British policy in British India. The initial missionaries, that went to India did not operate in British India. They operated out of Goa. The Portuguese Catholic settlement, because they could operate there and they couldn't operate in British India. Look, there are Christian influences in Australia, but a lot of what happened in early Australian history was this official upper class used morality to control the convicts and the lower class. And then we get the reaction. The reaction of the convict class that becomes part of Australian ethos that says they are hypocrites. They're not moral themselves, they're hypocrites. We look after each other. We take care of our mates. Those who rule us, who are officially Christian, are hypocritical. You see what I'm saying? Don't glamorise an early history of Australia that has all sorts of sin and all sorts of wrong. Yes, there have been Christian influences. Yes, they've done a great job. But there's a whole lot back there that's rotten. Now, the celebration of Jesus' birth is threatened. That is partly secular. It's partly using the excuse, well, the Muslims don't like it. Well, you need to understand Islam. Muslims have got no problem about Jesus. He's a prophet in Islam. What they object to is calling Jesus God. Give you another example. A not particularly commendable radio jock announcer made a derogatory comment recently about Mary. Don't know if you heard about this. It was crude. Who jumped on him? The Muslims. You don't say anything against Mary in Islam. Did you know that? That Jesus was born, that he was born of a virgin, that he is the Son of God, is crucial to our belief. What day he is born on, we have no idea. I don't get particularly worried about Christmas because we don't have any biblical basis. We have biblical basis for the birth of Jesus, not for the day he was born on. Let's not confuse issues. Let's not confuse a false view of early Australian history with reality. Let's not confuse traditional celebrations like Christmas with the reality that we hold both against Muslims and against secularists, that Jesus is the Son of God sent down for our redemption. Thank you.
Okay, who's next? Ken.
Thanks, Glenn. Dr. Weeks, I got a bit confused on your four-point Calvinism. And I've got a verse here from John. You'd be familiar with it, but I'll just read it out for everybody. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, nor of a husband's will, but born of God. So it seems in that verse there is human decision-making and there is also decision making by God. Can you sort of enlighten, pull that apart?
Amen. Thank you, Greg. I agree with you. There's human decision making. Ephesians chapter 2. And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. What's the biblical description of our natural condition? It is, we are lost in sin and depravity. But God, being rich in mercy, because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our transgressions, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. Those ones that your passage is talking about who came to faith in Christ, who didn't reject him, how did they do it? Because God worked in them. It's like I said, what happens to us is there is a point in which we hear the gospel or some other influence comes upon us, ultimately directed by God, and we see our condition and we see Christ. And we make the decision, but I'm unable to make the decision only because God has worked in me. Not saying there's no human decision. It's like, think of our sanctification. Is it you and I who come to the point of saying, look, all my life I've had a terrible temper. I've been a nuisance. I've had a terrible temper. But I now know that's wrong. And I pray for God's help to change. Have I come to that realization? Yes. Did I come to it alone? No. God worked in me. You understand? I do things because God does things. Yep.
Because it seems like in the parable of the sower, with the seed falling in the thorns and the rocky ground and the path and the good ground, that there is still a continuum through the working out of our salvation that is us accepting and living by faith. Is that consistent?
Actually, I'm not denying that. I'm saying that's a real experience, that's real to human experience. But how was I enabled to do that? Because of the mercy of God. Now, it can be different in terms of your experience. There are people who grow up in Christian homes and never know what it is to be a non-Christian. John the Baptist was regenerate in his mother's womb. Okay, that happens. But for those of you who at some point in your life became a Christian, can you remember what that was like? Can you remember the pulls, the tugs, the pressures? I have to go this way, but it's difficult. I don't want to go this way. But I know I'm a sinner. It's very real. It's very human. I went through that. It's only when you look back and read the Bible that you can say, God was there.
Okay, who's next? Ken.
Sorry to be the voice of controversy. In your talk, you started to talk about head covering, and then I was left hanging. I didn't get an answer about head covering or not head covering, and the interpretation of the Bible based on purely cultural grounds then and not being applicable now.
Yep. Yeah, I know I did the wrong thing. Yeah, and left you hanging. Okay. It comes back to 1 Corinthians 11. Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 is saying something about women's behaviour in church. Right? Now, what is he saying? The common interpretation says he is saying that the culture of the times regarded it as being immoral for women not to cover their heads in public. That's the common interpretation. People then commonly confuse that with Islamic practice, where there are forms of Islam that say that. But that's modern Islam. That's got nothing to do with the question. Get Islam out of it. So they then say, what on earth is Paul saying? If it's a difficult passage, we use this explanation of saying he is reacting to something going on at the time. And so they come up with this explanation that it was regarded as immoral for women not to cover their heads. Now, there are several problems with that explanation. Simple problem is there is no evidence of that belief in immorality. There's plenty of evidence that women were going around bareheaded. Second, if it was immoral for women not to cover their heads, it wouldn't just be in church. Islam does not say, if I can use that illustration, women should cover their heads in the mosque, but not anywhere else. If it's regarded as immoral, see, the position of Islam is women's hair is particularly attractive and encouraging to immorality. Well, if that's the problem, it's a problem whether they're in the mosque or not. If the belief of the time of the New Testament was that women's hair was encouraging to immorality, therefore all moral women covered their hair, it would apply whether they're in the church or not. But Paul's talking about in the church. I believe, and then, sorry, further point. If you go over to chapter 14, verse 34, the women are to keep silent in the churches, for it's not permitted for them to speak, but they are to subject themselves just as the law also says. If Paul is saying, according to the common interpretation, that women could speak in church as long as they covered their heads, he's contradicting what he says later. have an argument, and I can, you know, if you've got an email address, I can send you this argument. I've developed an argument on the basis of what the Greek says here, and on the basis of the logic that what Paul is actually arguing is women should not be teaching in the assembly, which is what he says in chapter 14. It's what he says in 1 Timothy. Now, I'm not appealing to the culture, I'm appealing to the language. But I can, you know, if you can give me an email address, or I can send on that article to you.
Who's next? Diane.
I wanted to ask about in the New Testament when God put all the different food on the sheet and said you can eat everything, how that works with Christians that think that kosher food is probably what we should still practice today, because some Christians do. But was the sheet not saying that all food is acceptable?
I'm going to ask for that question to be repeated.
I'll repeat the question. So referring to, I think it's Acts chapter 10, the sheet that Peter sees where God declares all foods clean. What does that mean for Christians today who believe that we should be eating kosher?
Sorry, start again. What passage?
Acts chapter 10.
Acts 10.
So Peter with the vision at Joppa.
Yep.
What do we say to Christians who believe that we should be eating kosher today? Was it a better way of eating, I imagine? Or?
Okay. The whole question, see, the real question comes back to Old Testament food laws. And the whole question of whether those Old Testament laws in their big scope apply to Christians. Okay. What you find Jesus saying is that those Old Testament laws I'm interpreting Jesus. He says all foods are clean. But what's the logic? The logic is this. The Old Testament has all sorts of laws that deal with physical things, that are encouraging people to make distinctions. For example, you cannot wear a garment composed of two different materials. You can't wear a garment, and I'll use things of biblical times, that is composed both of wool and linen. You can't sow your field with both barley and wheat. What are these laws teaching? They're teaching people to make a distinction. You can't eat animals that don't cleave the hoof and chew the cud. You can't eat non-ruminants in modern terminology. What are they teaching? They're teaching people to make distinctions. They're teaching it by means of external things. But Jesus then turns around and says, it's not what comes in the mouth that defiles, it's what comes out. The Old Testament is written in terms of teaching people to make distinctions in terms of external things. The New Testament, in a sense, is taking that and saying the real lesson is about internal things. It's the heart, not the external. Now, so in that passage in Acts, what Peter is going to end up wrestling with is, can he go and enter a Gentile household. See, Judaism and the way it had built the fence around the law said, if you go and eat in a Gentile household, you've no idea where the food came from. It could have been offered to an idol. See, in pagan societies, more animals are sacrificed than the priest can eat. What do? You with the excess? You sell it on the open market. If you go and buy your roast, how do you know where it came from? So a good Jew cannot eat in a Gentile household. That was the fence around the law. It wasn't sufficient to say to the Gentile, please don't serve me pork chops. You have to build a bigger fence around the law. Don't even eat in a Gentile household. What is going to happen to Peter in Acts is he's going to have this delegation from Cornelius who are going to say, come to our household and preach the gospel. He's entering a Gentile household. Does he accept their hospitality? Well, where's the food going to come from? That's the Jewish problem. God shows him in this vision that he's no longer making the separation. The external separation said, don't mix with the pagan stuff. What the New Testament is saying is, in your heart, don't mix with the pagan stuff. When the Muslims drag me in to feed me, can I go in? I might be served food where the animal was sacrificed with its throat cut pointing towards Mecca. That's the Muslim equivalent of kosher. Does it matter? No. For me as a Christian, if they say to me, worship is worship Allah, it matters. But it doesn't matter where the meat came from. The things that in the Old Testament were saying to Israel, avoid paganism, make distinctions, and were taught by physical examples, the New Testament is saying, make distinctions, but they're in your heart. They're moral, they're spiritual. Means you could have your barbecue with the Muslims. They'll be glad to have you.
If anyone does need to go, you're welcome to. That's okay. But thanks for joining us if you do need to head off. Anyone else like to ask a question? Where's that hand? I'm missing someone's hand, aren't I? No? All good? Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.